You've reached the Every Little Thing helpline. Please leave a message after the beep.
So this is probably definitely a sexual emergency, like level maybe 8-ish out of 10. When did pants become a thing?
When did pants become a thing? I love this listener's question. Unfortunately, this listener and I have opposite schedules. She goes to the Flamingo Enclosure on Mondays. I go Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. But we couldn't pass up investigating. And when we did, it got pretty pantaloony. So I invited someone who has spent years listening to people tell their clothes stories, writer and artist Emily Spivak, to the studio today to hear this yarn.
Oi.
How many puns are two?
I don't know. I've already counted. I think there have been two thus far.
So you're not into sophisticated jokes. Are you pro pants?
Yes. I am now exclusively wearing pants.
Why are you pants exclusive?
I don't know. I think I just feel far more comfortable in pants. I don't know exactly when that happened. It was a handful of years ago. Maybe two. I didn't like the pants that were out there. You know, when like there was like this trend where all you could find were like really low cut pants, or you know, your butt's hanging out or whatever. Like, I mean, obviously there were other pants out there. It wasn't like I was on like a desert island with only like low cut pants.
But a great concept for a Castaway sequel.
I just feel like there are more options.
Yeah, but clothes are more than butt coverings for you, right? Like, you think about clothes for a living.
Well, yes. I mean, I guess I do. Yeah.
You definitely do.
I do. Okay.
You've had an exhibit at the MoMA, the New York Modern Art Museum, about clothes. You've written two books about clothes. What interests you about them?
My interest is far more about clothing than it is about fashion, like with a capital F. I'm interested in what we can learn about people through the things that they wear every day. I love the fact that clothing is democratic. I mean, we all have to wear clothing every day. I mean, unless, you know, you live on a nudist colony or something.
On that desert island with just the low-cut pants.
It's either nothing or low-slung pants.
Do you know much about the history of pants?
A little. Pants are just like kind of one thing I haven't done a lot of exploration around.
Good. Because we are digging deep into the pockets of pants history, and I want you to be surprised about what we fish out.
Okay.
Let me start by introducing you to Ulrike Beck, who studies ancient pants.
I really approach a garment like a crime scene. It's for me like the garments are like silent witnesses, but they still tell stories about their owner, about their creator, about the society, and I try to extract these informations.
Oh, I love that.
Ulrike is a forensic panthropologist.
Oh, no. Oi.
Wow, a second oi. Okay. That's going to be the new drinking game for this podcast. Every time you hear Emily oi, take a drink. So our quest today is to find out how pants became a thing. When do you think they arrived in our closets?
Well, I think that they arrived in our closets before we had closets. I mean, ancient.
Prehistory. Like, as soon as we had clothes, someone would have figured out.
It's cold. My knees are chilly.
Okay, so it might surprise you to learn that pants are old, but they're not that old. There's evidence that clothing dates back 170,000 years, but pants only come on the scene 3,000 years ago.
Yes, so the oldest trousers we know for now were dated to a time around 13th to 10th century BC, or say it more exactly, around 1028 BC.
1028 BC, the birth of pants.
There's a specific date?
There's a specific date because there is an earliest pair of pants ever found.
These were excavated in western China by Chinese archaeologists.
What was found exactly?
They discovered a natural mummified corpse of a man in a tomb.
He was part of a nomadic tribe that lived in the desert in western China.
and everything was still preserved. So he was completely dressed, and he was wearing a woolen poncho with a woolen belt, a leather cap, leather boots, jewelry like earrings, and a pair of trousers.
Wow. This guy must look good.
I got a real village person vibe.
Yes.
Leather cap, poncho, yes. Earrings.
Oh, my God. He was, like, already in style. And, you know, the 70s are referencing this guy.
Can I show you a picture of these primordial pants?
Please. Exhibit A.
ELT listeners, we'll put this on our Instagram at ELT show.
Oh, they have. Wait, how did. Okay. First of all, they're, like, beautiful.
Yes, they are really, really beautifully made.
They're straight leg pant.
Very straight leg. Like, it looks like how a kid would draw pants. Boxy.
Yes. And they have these incredible patterns, on, like patches on the knees. I feel like that's the part that's the most surprising to me, is the decoration. They're, like, styly.
I know. That geometric pattern looks like it belongs on a modern rug.
It does. What are these? What were they made out of?
So they're made of brown and cream sheep's wool, three pieces of fabric.
They were custom made, and they would have taken months to make.
Each piece was shaped and formed on the loom, and every detail was shaped and formed in at the right place and in the right size.
The right size for a man. As far as we know, these pants were menswear only. And the man who owned them would probably have them for life, which is probably why they were so decorative.
When you imagine that you have trousers very, very long time that are your trousers, why not make them beautiful?
Yeah, I'm on the same page. And then also the crotch is interesting.
Ooh, you are nosing something out that helps solve the mystery of these pants.
Okay.
And they are mysterious. Remember, before 1028 BC, there is not a scrap of evidence of pants anywhere on Earth. Then this nomadic village person shows up in the desert in western China wearing beautiful trousers with an enormous crotch, which somehow you noticed.
Hard to miss. It's real gathered. It's a real bunchy crotch.
The crotch piece in the middle was huge. It was much wider than you would normally need it to do the normal walk. So it was enormous.
Emily, I want you to put your forensic anthropologist hat on. What activity might be so terrible without pants that you would have to invent them? Again, the giant crotch is a clue.
Well, I just kind of like how it looks. I'm inspired by that.
Stylistically.
I think it's kind of interesting. But I think that there's clearly a mobility issue here. These pants accommodate a lot of movement. Are they like riding a horse?
You are on the right track.
Okay.
With the horse.
Oy.
Drink up. The man in pants was found with a horse whip and bridle in the tomb.
Nice work.
You.
Yeah. Nice work, me.
He apparently belonged to the North Asian horse riding people.
And just picture riding a horse for hours without pants, bare backside.
Serious chafing?
Yeah.
Is there serious chafing that's happening?
I think it's safe to assume.
What would they have been wearing beforehand to ride the horse?
Loincloth and tube socks?
Oh, you
can see why it makes sense that pants were invented.
It was really, really a genius idea to come up with them.
Yes, they're practical and they're beautiful. And I like that philosophy. I mean, that's sort of a philosophy I think about in terms of the way that I want to dress. I also kind of want to wear these pants. Like, I'm into them.
I have some good news for you.
What?
Ulrika recreated them.
No.
Yeah, she wanted to know what it would be like to wear them.
Of course, I tried them on just to know how it feels. So they're kind of, yes, they're kind of comfy. I mean, there's a lot in the middle. I mean, the crotch is huge indeed.
Anyway, she has a replica.
For like general public consumption?
No, you'd have to befriend her.
I'll send her an email.
All right, are you up for another leg of the pants journey?
Oh, God. Oi.
After the break, the traveling sisterhood of the stationary pants.
These warlike women who could ride horses and fight and be just as courageous and deadly as the men, that really struck the Greeks.
Emily, ready to get back on the horse?
Let's talk about women.
My pleasure. The first lady in pants that we know of belonged to a group called the Scythians. Have you heard of them?
No.
Okay. Historian Adrian Mayer has the details for us.
The Scythians are the peoples, nomadic steppe peoples who rode horses, shot bows and arrows, and their land stretched from the Black Sea area all the way to China.
They're living a few hundred years after the village person, from about 700 BC to 400 AD. And it's a collection of people living over a vast area.
There were lots of different tribes, thousands of different tribes of these people, but they were culturally related because they all spent their lives on horseback.
And this is what's unusual. For the Scythians, it's equal opportunity horsing around.
Everyone knows how to ride a horse, boys and girls, men and women.
Everyone knows how to shoot a bow and arrow.
And they all dressed the same.
Unlike everywhere else in the world, men and women both wore pants.
I'm into it. This is a good story.
The Scythians are nomadic warriors, and they come in contact with other groups of people. And when this egalitarian pants-wearing people ride up, other civilizations are shocked and awed.
Shocked and awed by their pants-wearing, or shocked and awed because they're getting attacked?
Both. So the Scythians show up in ancient Greece, and I just want you to picture this. You've got Greek men in their mini togas.
Okay.
You have Greek women in their floor-length togas, and it's a very binary culture. And then in ride these strangers, men and women on horseback with their bows and arrows, all wearing pants. They attracted some attention.
The idea of these warlike women who could ride horses and fight and be just as courageous and deadly as the men, that really struck the Greeks.
Struck them, freaked them the fuck out, that might be another way to put it.
They liked to be able to tell right away whether someone was male or female. The fact that the men and women wore exactly the same costume, that really disturbed the Greeks.
Disturbed them enough that the Scythians became the stuff of legends.
The idea of these real women warriors must have influenced the stories of Amazons. Amazons were fierce women warriors in the myths, and they lived in exotic lands to the east. And every Greek hero had to prove himself by fighting an Amazon queen.
For instance, there's this famous myth about Achilles fighting the Amazon queen Penthesilea.
She was an ally of the Trojans, so Penthesilea helped them defend Troy against the Greeks, who were led by Achilles, and she had a famous duel with Achilles, and they were equally matched. Now, the story is told by the Greeks, so you can guess who wins.
And you can also guess what she was wearing.
She would have been dressed in her resplendent trousers and tunic.
Her outfit is a part of the myth.
Like, they had to include that detail.
Exactly. The pants are also immortalized on Greek pottery, like, and we'll put some pictures on our Instagram at ELT show. On Greek vases, you have Zeus, Hercules, women in pants.
Trousers.
So we know where the story goes from here. From the Scythians, pants spread, and so did the fear of women wearing pants. A pantalunophobia so powerful, we are still talking about it.
But I think we broke new ground. And that was helped by my insistence on wearing pants, you know, jeans. And
that's actress Mary Tyler Moore talking about her fight to have her character dress in pants. That was the 1960s. American public schools could require girls to wear dresses until the early 70s. And it goes on.
Barbara Mikulski remembers what a man's world the Senate was when she came 24 years ago.
To come on the floor in trousers was viewed as a seismographic event. I had to alert Senator Byrd.
It was against the rules for women to wear pants in the Senate until 1993.
Yeah, it's been that way for a long time, I guess.
That's what's so crazy. It's been that way for so long. Like, women in pants have been shocking men for 3,000 years.
Get over it.
It also makes the Scythian society even more surprising. It's like, Scythians?
Yeah.
Why don't I hear more about you?
Yeah. 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 Or, like, why is there a band called, like, the Scythians? Because there kind of should be.
We know the outfits.
Yeah.
Those pants. Crotch bunching.
Good for mosh pits. This is, I feel like you're really giving me a lot to think about.
How so?
Just the fact that this is something that has been going on so long, and the, like, the deep history, some of these deep cuts that, yeah.
Are you going to oi yourself?
Oh, no. You just can't help it.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, it just comes out of your mouth without even trying. Oy.
Thanks for coming on the show, Emily.
Thanks for having me.
Hi, ELT. This is Casey from St. Louis, Missouri, and recently I listened to the TSA episode, and I have a burning follow-up question. I just have to know if Kimberly was ever reunited with her snow globe.
Casey's right. There is more to this story. You might remember a few shows back on our TSA treasure chest episode, Kimberly called us about her experience with airport security.
And so we're running. Our flight leaves in like 20 minutes. The line is moving, so I'm like, I think we're gonna make it. And then one of my bags gets pulled aside, and I said, I don't know what the problem is here. I think there's a cactus candle holder in one of these, and I think there might be a snow globe. And he's like, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Kimberly made it through the checkpoint, but her rainbow snow globe did not. The way we left it in our last episode, there was a glimmer of hope that Kimberly would get that snow globe back from the Pennsylvania State Surplus Agency that takes TSA confiscated items. We have been in constant contact with them, and that's why producer Phoebe and I are here today visiting the school where Kimberly teaches.
I feel like now, since talking to you last, I've really had an idea that the snow globe is like on its own journey, and I've really tried to let it go. But I really also have high hopes that perhaps that journey involves it sort of like coming like a boomerang back to me.
So we wanted to close the loop.
Great.
And come here today with a special delivery.
I am ready. I'm sitting down. I'm ready.
Phoebe, will you present?
Yes. Let's see. Oh. Okay, so I just want to describe this. So this is not actually a rainbow snow globe. It looks like it is a peacock snow globe.
As you've picked up, this is not your snow globe.
Did someone nab the rainbow snow globe?
What we heard from the state surplus agency in Pennsylvania is that probably TSA threw it away.
That's horrible.
I know.
Oh, that's very sad.
I know. We couldn't leave Kimberly empty-handed. So we went shopping at a TSA store that sells surrendered items and picked up this replacement snow globe.
Did someone really get this confiscated by TSA?
Yes, indeed. And we wondered if you might be okay with adoption.
I feel that I am. I actually feel like this might even be a little better than my snow globe. I mean, this is the tail of the peacock is swooping down. It's covered with glitter. There are real feathers on it. It's a real conversation piece. Oh, I want to thank you so much.
Well, thank you for being such a good sport, even though we didn't actually give you the thing that you wanted. You
gave me the thing that I wanted more that I didn't even know. And if anybody out there listening to this podcast finds out that they really miss their incredibly gorgeous peacock snow globe, just let me know, because, you know, I know how that would feel to get something returned to you.
I love that. Okay, listeners, if you lost your peacock snow globe, give us a ring, 833-RING-ELT.
Yeah, you might have to fight me for it, but we'll figure something out.
If you have a burning question you cannot find an answer to, give us a call, 833-RING-ELT. You can also find us on Twitter and Instagram at ELT Show.
Every Little Thing is produced by Aaron Reese, Bibi Flanagan, Annette Heist, and Flora Lichtman, with help from Nicole Pasulka and Doug Barron. Our consulting editors are Caitlin Kenny and Jorge Just. Mixed by Dara Hirsch. Scored by Dara Hirsch and Bobby Lord. Oy. Goodbye.